You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We set a course for the high seas as we go on the hunt for a variety of monstrous creatures lurking in the depths of the world's oceans. Our guide and captain on this perilous journey is author Max Hawthorne, who discusses some of the incredible encounters and witness statements from all around the globe, taken from his book Marine Monsters and Mysteries. We've a series of terrifying incidents involving giant squid attacking US Navy ships, boats and catamarans, monstrous giant octopi stalking the shallows and scaring fishermen witless, some strange tales of enormous turtles witnessed off the coast of Canada, and much, much more. After listening to Max, you may think twice about booking that cruise of a lifetime. A big thank you to Max for a thoroughly fascinating, yet frightening conversation. Don't forget, before that, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters or clicking the link in the show notes as always. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, and bonus content. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is, of course, produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Well, after this episode, I'm not sure we'll be able to find any boat big enough to be dealing with some of these behemoths. On today's episode, we set a course for high seas on the hunt for marine monsters and terrifying tales of real encounters in the company of the Prince of Paleo Fiction, Max Hawthorne. Max's award-winning Kronos Rising series has been terrifying readers for almost a decade. Max has continued to push the boundaries of water-themed terror. Max, I am finally delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. Welcome.
It's my privilege to be here, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me, Max. As I said during our sort of little chat before we dove into this interview, I feel like I've known you for quite a long time, primarily through your appearances on other shows that I listen to on a regular basis. And it's a deeply interesting subject, the work that you find yourself sort of entrenched in, because you've really sort of made a niche for yourself terrifying people out of the water, haven't you?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I do get some people I scare on land also. I think one of my favorite reviews, and I don't often read reviews on Amazon. I mean, nobody has time, honestly. But this one review somebody mentioned when I looked at it, and she was saying how she was talking about Kronos Rising, the very first book in the series. And she said her title of her review was like, scariest book I ever read. And then she was like, it was so intense and so frightening. She said, I cleaned my entire house in a weekend. She said, I was like, read like a chapter until I couldn't take it anymore. And then I would put it down, and then to take my mind off it, I would clean the bathroom. And then I'd come back to it and I'd read some more, and then I'd clean the powder room. And then I put it down, I couldn't take it anymore, and I cleaned this. And she said, you know, but literally, and I was very flattered by that. I mean, I guess it's the intensity of the writing or something. I don't find it scary, but then again, I don't have an 80-foot pliosaur trying to impale me with its fangs so that my intestines are spilling out or something. I don't know if that's in there, but no.
Obviously, she liked it, so. I don't blame her, and to be fair, that could be a good way to promote the book, you know, guaranteed to clean your house in 2 days, read Max Hawthorne. So, and probably cheaper than other alternative ways of getting things done, I would imagine.
Yes. You know, you want to take these things in doses, you know? I mean, too much. And plus, it lets the book last a little longer. I mean, some people complain. They're like, you know, you'll see them say, or they'll tell me on social media, say, I finished the book. Now what do I do? I'm like, I'm confused. What do you mean? It's like, well, what am I supposed to do with the rest of my life? I'm like, what? What does that mean? Like, well, I feel like I was in this great adventure and now it's over and I'm very sad and I don't know what to do. And I'm like, I don't know. They're like, are you going to write another book? I'm like, yeah. They're like, where do you live? I'm like, click, you know. Hang that up.
Yeah, very true. When you decided to dive into this, because obviously the first Kronos book came out sort of, what was it, 2012, 2013, Max, I think, around that era?
It was written in 04 and 05, and then it sat in a drawer because, you know, I had a baby, you know, I didn't have a baby, my wife had a baby, but, you know, and it released, I think, in 2014, if memory serves.
Yeah. So what was it that drew you into this? Because I'm a lover of sea monsters in general. Was that something that you'd always had a fascination with? I know you're an avid sportsman. You're a deeply passionate conservationist as well. You enjoy fishing and going out on the water. Was it a subject that you've always had a deep interest in, Max? Or are you one of these people that it was something else that kind of drew you into these marine-based monsters?
Well, let's see. I mean, I've been into prehistoric life since I was a little kid. I mean, like 4 years old, 5 years old. I think I was four. I remember going to my sister's first grade science exhibit. And this is when Aurora Prehistoric Scenes model kits were out.
Yeah.
You know, the snap together, really gorgeous dinosaurs. And I saw them and I was like, wow, like this is the most amazing thing in the world. You know, and I got like my first one was just an Allosaurus. And then I had a father who was what they call a rock hound. So he had a jewelry store, but he also used to buy and sell fossils and minerals, things like that. So I grew up seeing like huge prehistoric shark teeth and giant bones and trilobites and you name it. I mean, it's like I surrounded it. We went to museums every year, like the Museum of Natural History in New York. I saw it back then before they fixed the, you know, the posturing of like the Tyrannosaurus Rex and everything else. So, you know, really old stuff. But so it's kind of always been there. And then I became a passionate angler and the two sort of like combined, I guess you'd say, like a love of the water, marine life, a love of prehistoric life. And then also you got to think like when you're in the water, it's like land-based stories, like sci-fi, thrillers, stuff like, Jurassic Park, Jurassic World are all very scary, but none of that, like being chased by a Tyrannosaurus or an Indominus Rex or whatever, is as scary as the opening scene of Jaws when that poor girl gets grabbed and dragged back and forth to her death. You know, that brings the fear home because if you think about it, and one of the things that my readers like that when they say like, I scare the hell out of them is when you're in the water, you're helpless. I mean, like on land, we're comparatively slow and not really, we don't have claws, we don't have fangs, we don't have the strength of an anthropoid, et cetera. And we're not really top of the food chain, but in the water, you're a slug. We're like bait. You know, and when you're at the surface, if you don't even have scuba gear, et cetera, or at night, and you can't even see it coming, I mean, my God, anything could be down there. You know, something touched your leg, you're like, and you can't get away. You know, seriously. I mean, like, you know, I knew people play practical swim on the water and grab somebody's leg by the beach or something. Yeah, it's a really mean thing to do.
Yeah.
You know? Kick or something like that. I never did it. Okay. But, you know, so yeah, that's, it's a scary position to be in. You're completely powerless. The fastest human swimmer in the world is like 1/10 the strike speed of a barracuda.
Yeah.
So, you know, it loans itself, I guess you'd say, to that. But are you asking me what inspired me to write the Kronos book itself or just the whole genre?
Essentially, what was that leap into that, creating that whole sort of pantheon of the stories that have built on the original book? And why was it that sort of aspect of it that you wanted to create this series of books based on these terrifying events that start at this beautiful seaside resort at the beginning?
Well, it's, I mean, the seaside resort comes from all the time I spent in Florida in the Keys and stuff like that, down there fishing and stuff. I've been doing that for decades. But Hemingway, it's Hemingway's fault that this all started. Because, no, I'm serious. I swear. I was down there. I was like, my first time in the Keys, I was like 31, which is over 25, 26 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was down there in, what's it called? Outdoor World, I think it is, by Bass Pro. It's a big shop, like in Marathon or one of those islands, Keys. And in there, they have a boat that Hemingway had fished off of. It was the sister ship of his boat, the Pilar, which is in Cuba. And it was like a clone. You know, this big, old, dark wood vessel. I believe he had even souped it up or the other one up to use to fight Nazis with World War II. He put like torpedoes on it, tubes and a machine gun and all this other stuff. He was industrious, I'll say.
Yeah.
But so this one did not have torpedo tubes, I don't think, on it and all that stuff. But it did have a fighting chair that he'd fished off of, which was inspiring to me because, you know, I fish. To sit in the same fighting chair as Papa was something. But then what happened is I went down, there was a little step down section there, and they had his writing desk and they had the actual typewriter that he wrote The Old Man and the Sea on.
Yeah.
And I sat at his desk and I'm using his typewriter. And it was like, I swear, I heard this little voice in my ear go, "You can do this." And I was like, "I can do this." You know, like, it was like this weird thing. Yeah. And the ideas just started coming. And the whole basis for Cronus Rising, I mean, it's going to be a spoiler for people that aren't familiar with the series a little bit, but you know, the whole idea was, how can you come up with something unique, innovative, and believable where you can have prehistoric marine life, huge prehistoric animals the size of a large whale, be surviving to the present and yet never encountered by people, you know, totally isolated? And if you look at sci-fi movies and things, I mean, we've seen it all. We've seen, you know, giant mantises frozen in icebergs.
Yeah.
The Titanic down the fathoms, I think, was similar. You know, we've had, oh my gosh, I mean, atomic bombs. We've had splits opening in the oceans, I mean, crust at the bottom of the sea. You know, we've had, you know, deep things coming from the abysses, all this different stuff. Okay. And all these explanations, a lot of how these things survive, but a lot of them don't seem plausible.
Hmm.
And you really want to achieve what we call in fiction writing a suspension of disbelief, meaning that people are so engrossed in a story and what you give them seems so factual, they're like, yeah, that could happen, I can see that. And that disappears. And then they become more engrossed in what you're telling them and it just carries with them with the story. So the first thing that really dawned on me, I mean, I was, you know, really into, I had this book, I forget what the name of it is, when I was little, but about these giant prehistoric marine reptiles and all that. It might have been by Zdenek Bury and one of these artists and stuff. And so this Kronosaurus was always, you know, a favorite of mine. It was on my radar, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, that'd be a great, you know, story. And then like it dawned on me of how I could do this. And I created a fictitious caldera off the coast of Cuba. For people that might not know what a caldera is a dormant or extinct volcano that millions of years earlier typically has exploded with so much ferocity that the top two thirds or more of it is gone.
Yeah.
And all that's left is this bowl shaped depression, like Crater Lake here in the United States.
There, yeah.
Okay, as an example. So I created an oceanic caldera called Diablo Caldera off the coast of Cuba. And at the time of the Chicxulub impact, I had a scene going on, like in Cronus Rising, is where people love the Cretaceous flashback scenes.
Yeah.
Where I have interactions between prehistoric life. So I have this mating chase going on where this female Pliosaur, this Kronosaurus imperator, was the scientific name we came up with, or I came up with, is being pursued by, you know, half a dozen amorous would-be male mates that are chasing her to prove their worth, etc. And as this is going on, the asteroid strikes hundreds or a thousand miles away, whatever it was, together, and boom, and temporarily blinds the creatures. And then this tidal wave comes up, which obviously we know was caused by the impact, which sweeps up the surviving pliosaurs and the ecosystems all around them, because you're talking about tsunamis that were 1,000 meters or more tall.
Yeah.
Boom. And it swamps this caldera, overruns it, it keeps going as waves do, and turns it into a giant saltwater aquarium. It's now a lake, an 8 mile wide saltwater lake. Now, obviously, a lot of the creatures in there would have been killed on impact, et cetera. That was all, you know, the dead, the dying, littering the surface. You know, it's pretty intense stuff. But and so I was able to create this idea that there could be this saltwater lake that was filled with marine life, and the geothermal activity of the dormant volcano would even keep them from freezing during the impact winter that followed the strike, the asteroid strike, and ice ages, et cetera. So it was almost like a heater for an aquarium.
Yeah.
See? And then fast forward 66 million years and you have like a tremors and that thing splits open a bit and some of what's in there gets out.
Yeah.
And once it's out, obviously, you know, apex predators exploring a new environment are going to do what they're going to do. They're going to explore. They're going to set up territory. They're going to try and reproduce. You know, they're going to do what they do. And along the way, the sole creature that escapes encounters the hero and heroine of the story and does what it does, which is eat. And it eats everything. It takes down whales. It takes down boats. I mean, it's merciless. It's not afraid of people. It's used to being the top of the food chain and nothing can stop it. So it has a battle with a sperm whale thousands of feet down fighting over a giant squid that the whale had. Yeah, a lot of intense stuff. So a lot of research obviously was in a book like that. But yeah, so that's how it all kind of happened and herded into it. And it was such a, it was a very successful book. Won a Book of the Year award and it was very popular. And I left the door open at the end of it if I wanted to do more. And sure enough, I did. And then it just kind of expanded and expanded. And now there's a whole Cronus Rising universe out there. I mean, the recent books are like 30 or more years into the future from that. It's almost like a dystopian type setup, et cetera.
I'm really fascinated by this because it, for someone that's had a love of monsters of the sea and the strange things that have been reported all around the world, Max, from the shores of North America to all around the British Isles and Europe and off the coasts of South Africa and places like this. I find it remarkable that even in this modern era, there are some people that just presume there is nothing left to discover in the oceans. And I find it peculiar that there are certain parts of the scientific community that just don't seem to understand or look back at the things that have been discovered over the years, because we often talk about how the giant squid was often poo-pooed as a tall tale by overexcitable sailors, and yet in the modern era we are very aware of these creatures, and yet our knowledge of these monsters is increasing year on year as we make more discoveries. And we're getting the technology to take us further down into the ocean's depths to come across even larger specimens. And so many options of other kind of creatures have been reported all around the world. And yet people go, oh, well, there's no possibility that anything gigantic could still be in the ocean, which I find laughable.
Oh, it's hilarious. I mean, the arrogance, the presumptuousness to assume that we know everything when we know nothing. I mean, let's be realistic. It always cracks me up that I think I know a lot about a topic, and I find any topic like fossils or anything like that, you know, that I find I know so little myself. But you're talking about water. Millions and millions of cubic miles of water with an average depth of, I think it's 11,000 feet.
Yeah.
And only 5% of the ocean floor, not the vertical part, has been explored. And I spoke to a guy that recently, and I got some footage he sent me, and he was working on a submarine, and their submarine's job was to map parts of the ocean floor. And I'm not going to say where this happened or when or anything like that, but he came across strange whale graveyards where there was a lot of dead whales all within like a 1 square kilometer area and no logical reason for them to all be there in terms of current, in terms of topography, anything like that. And these whales were all in the same, they were all sperm whales, and they all ranged from like 30, like 60 feet in length. And some of them were old, like as in 5 or 10 years old. Some of them were fresher, et cetera. But, you know, they were all there and something is putting them there. See, I believe it's like when my book, Monsters and Marine Mysteries, and I talked about mega squid.
Yep.
These historical sightings and such. If you look at these woodcuts and things of these different sightings out there, gosh, Yeah, in the section of Monster Interception, I discuss like Kraken sightings and such. And there are so many sightings historically that if you go back and you look at them, this one was the Delia. Okay, it was one. And then there's another one called, well, that one they saw a whale on the surface, which they said was a big humpback, and it was fighting, quote, a sea serpent, which was wrapped around the whale several times.
Yeah.
Okay. But if you look at the incident and the image, is it a sea serpent or are they the tentacles of something very big?
Mm.
See? I mean, sea serpents, there's never been any evidence of any monstrous serpent out there. And a serpent, the size, if you look at the thing, could never swallow a whale that big. So that makes no sense. And humpbacks aren't predators, so they wouldn't be attacking anything. Or, oh, it was the humpback who was feeding on the squid. No, it doesn't work like that. But all these images all look like something wrapped around the whale. The Pauline is another example, which the guy said the biggest sperm whale he'd ever seen had this thing wrapped around it, which he thought it was a serpent. And then the serpent lifts up like its tail out of the air and smashes the whale with it repeatedly. It's trying to like stun it or knock the air out of it or what. Obviously, it was experienced. And eventually, it drags the whale under and it's never seen again. And I believe that sometimes these squid get so enormous, they actually feed on whales, even sperm whales. This is the inspiration for the Chronotrichy Kraken series, where sometimes a sperm whale goes down hunting and he never comes back because there's something down there. Like they wait, like the sperm whales are their food.
Mm.
And that's what goes on. So the sign incident that we were talking about before is a prime example of that. You've got a warship, a 400 and something foot destroyer that is attacked. I think it was 1978.
Yeah.
A 4,200 ton Knox class destroyer, 1978, leaves San Diego. And it shortly after leaving, there's different accounts of this, but where the ship all of a sudden shudders and it keeps going. But then the sonar is no longer operational. They can't see anything. That's obviously a problem for any ship, let alone a warship. So they turn around and go back. The sonar dome, and I had to do massive amounts of research for this for the book, was coated with a no foul rubber coating.
Yeah.
And a huge percentage of the, I think it was like 80 or 90% of the sonar dome, which is 26 feet across, keep in mind. So that's a big dome shaped part of the vessel, okay, is all shredded. So just in that brief instant, what could shred that much square footage? You see what I'm saying? And each of those shreds had these little claws in there. These little claws turned out to be squid claws that ring their suckers, and they were five times bigger than any known specimen. So apparently a ridiculously large squid was underneath there, you know, drifting along, and the sign passed over it, and the sign's active sonar is in the same range as a sperm whale's hunting sonar. I researched all this for the book. It's all in there. And the squid must have been like, whoa. And that dome would look like a sperm whale's head.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there. So the squid must have thought it was being attacked by a whale that was actually big enough to eat it. It lashed out, it attacked the ship, you know, and then it pulled back and said, okay, this is not edible. This is not biological, whatever. And it got out of Dodge, but it managed to damage a United States warship. So that's a serious squid.
It is indeed. I've actually seen footage of the petty officer of the sign being interviewed, who talks quite openly about what happened to him, Max, as well as a marine biologist who actually had a portion of this rubber covering. And it looks like it's been hit with a shotgun. It's just absolutely shredded. And he had a couple of the claws that were embedded in it. So I've seen people who have dismissed this story as an urban myth, as an exaggeration or anything, and yet I've seen footage of it, I've seen the evidence, it really happened, and it's a remarkable incident when you've got members of the US Navy talking openly about some weird creature attacking them, because this was a big, like you say, this was a big old ship that was out there, and it was completely disabled, it had to come back for repair.
I crunched the numbers, and there's an illustration there showing size, potential size ranges for this thing. And it matches up with several other incidents, like from World War II, There was one incident where a British trawler, military trawler, had a squid come up next to the ship, and the witness saw it, and it was the length of his ship, which was 175 feet.
Yeah.
And that doesn't include the long feeding tentacles that shoot out. So, I mean, that's a monstrous thing, and that would be about the size. And then there was another, like, 150-foot schooner called the Pearl that was attacked by a gigantic squid and was pulled over and sank in front of witnesses. And that squid sounds like in the same size. So it seems like, you know, there's a species out there potentially that gets to this enormous size, or Architeuthis or something, and continue to grow to ridiculous proportions until they're feeding on sperm whales and other whales for that matter.
Yeah. I remember there was a British soldier, I think, called Lieutenant Cox. It's a very famous story from the Second World War, Max, that he was on a troop ship that got sunk by a German submarine in the South Atlantic. And he was adrift in the sea for, I think, 6 or 7 days. He survived, obviously. But he was saying that after they'd all sort of dealt with the ramifications of the ship going down and everybody sort of fighting off the sharks that were coming around to pick off the carcasses and stuff, after 5 days, they suddenly realized that there was something else that far more frightening that they needed to be aware of, because something with gigantic tentacles picked two people off this raft that they were on, and he was attacked and only held on by the other people that had survived with him. And he was covered in scars up his legs, and he showed his family and his friend.
I saw it. I saw the footage.
Yeah.
Those are the hooks. Well, yeah. They dig in there. Yeah. So then that shows you these squid are not, they're intelligent. They're opportunistic. It knew there was a floating buffet. If I recall correctly, it came up at night.
Yes.
And each night, like, I think before he was grabbed, they lost two different people, like you said. Like, each night, one person was taken. You know, like, just pulled over, like, splash, and they were gone. They're like, where'd Joe go? You know? And I think they even tied themselves all together or something, if memory serves. I mean, it's been a long time. But yeah, he was being dragged and pulled, and I think they managed to cut the arm off or something and drive it away. Yeah. It's terrifying. But it shows you they will eat people.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's, I don't know if this would be of interest, but since we're touching on squid and stuff, you know, there's been this long standing legend since 1969 about this creature they call the Kodiak dinosaur. And this is a story where a shrimping boat was, well, obviously shrimping, but working Raspberry Straits off Kodiak Island, Alaska.
Yes.
And on their echo sounder, they got an image of something that was underneath the boat that they estimated, the estimates range from 150 to 200 feet in length. And the sonar image showed something that had this weird, like, long neck with a head at the end, and then a body and some sort of weird, like, flipper at the other end, all this stuff. There's been a lot of mystery about, you know, the original sound imagery and stuff. I saw it many years back online, and then it disappeared, meaning, like, I believe it was redacted, as they call it. And that can happen. I know NASA has redacted some stuff that was released, et cetera. So it's not like impossible. And there's another image out there, which I don't believe is legit at all. It looks so much like a plesiosaur or a brontosaurus from the Flintstones that it's embarrassing to look at it.
Yeah.
Okay. I saw the original image, and it was like swimming in a straight line, and it doesn't look at all like the replacement image, I'm going to call it out there. I'm just going to say my opinion. That's my belief. I saw the original, and I actually, from memory, drew a sketch of what the original looked like. And I put it, like, on my website and all, because I'm not doing a cryptid book anytime soon. And as I was looking at it, I realized, because, you know, I'm like, well, wait, if this is a plesiosaur, everybody was saying it was an immense plesiosaur. Okay. Like, that was their theory. This long neck, the small head at the end, the body, and then this weird, like, flipper and tail at the other, at the far end.
Yeah.
But it didn't make sense to me because there was no front paddles. And I know a lot about plesiosaurs and locomotion because I've done a formal paper on how plesiosaurs swam. Okay.
Yeah.
But, so that didn't make sense. And then other people were saying, oh, it was a Bacillosaurus, you know, that's an extinct primitive whale, very long, that type of thing, you know, like a crocodile-like head at one end, flippers up front, pectoral fins, instead of really long, elongated body, and it floops at the end.
Yeah.
Okay. But that didn't make sense either, because it didn't, like, the whole anatomy, et cetera, at all. And I was trying to think, I'm looking, saying, what could this be? And then I realized it's a freaking squid.
Yeah.
That's what it was that passed under that boat. Because if you look at it, the quote head at the end of the long neck is the clubs.
Yep.
You know, the tentacles bunched together. The long neck is the tentacles are all together because they streamline as they swim. They don't leave them, you know, fluttering in the breeze,
yep,
et cetera. Then you've got the body, the mantle, and then what looks like a weird head and a weird flipper at the other end is the caudal fin undulating as the thing's swimming. You know, when they're not jetting, we'll call it, you know, drawing water in through their siphon and expelling it from the mantle to move quickly, they just, you know, use that caudal fin to flutter along. And that's what it was. Mm-hmm. It has to be that, pure and simple. And that makes perfect sense. And it's in the size range of the Stein squid and the other squids that we talked about. So crazy.
Absolutely. But to me, that makes far more sense than making these massive leaps that sometimes you get when they talk about monsters of the sea. It has to be some remnant dinosaur, Max. Mm-hmm. Whereas for me, like you've just explained there, I've heard about that particular incident, and as they described it, my first thought was, well, it has to be some kind of giant squid, as you've perfectly described the body shape and everything there. That makes far more sense and is easily more plausible, because we know there are giants in the oceans. We've just yet to sort of come across them, and I suspect if anybody does have the misfortune of coming across one, we probably wouldn't hear about it anyway, because they'd probably lunge.
That's the problem.
But there seems to be a lot of things that go on that side of North America, because I know there's been tons of reports off the coast of Newfoundland as well and down to Vancouver of people having encounters with giant squids. And I'm not too sure whether this is still relevant or it's been misproven, but a lot of people used to believe that the colour red was an attraction to squids. And often when sailors went into the sea, especially during the Second World War, a lot of North American sailors and servicemen were issued with red life jackets, and a lot of them were apparently taken after ships had been sunk by the Japanese off that coast by squids in that area. Was that something you uncovered when you were doing your research at all?
I didn't, but I do remember reading about that years and years back. I mean, you got to think, number one, like the Humboldt squid, which do attack and have
yes.
They call them the Diablos Rojas, which is like the red devils.
Yes.
When they're aggressive, they turn red.
Mm.
So that's one thing. But also, it's the color of blood.
Yeah.
So you're basically ringing the dinner bell. There's blood in the water already. You're wearing something. It looks like you have this immense wound on your torso. I mean, that would make perfect sense to me. And squids, like you said, are opportunistic. They're going to go where the food is, et cetera. I mean, it gets to the point where, like, during war, where you're constantly having ships being sunk, torpedoes, bombs, explosions, followed by hundreds, if not thousands, of bodies in the water and blood everywhere. These creatures also learn to associate those sounds with a dinner bell. No, and I know, like, I've gone shark fishing many years ago, and they would, when they were having a hard time bringing sharks in, with everything else, they would light M80s, which is like a quarter stick of dynamite, and throw them in the water and whoop, whoop, and these explosions. And within like 10, 15 minutes, you see fins coming.
Yeah.
So apparently they're like, ooh, what is that? And they're like, ooh, I smell something good. You know, it's like Bruce the shark from Finding Nemo. That's good. You know, that kind of thing. And then they just come gone. So, I mean, I would think a squid, especially at night, I mean, that's, they're like one of the top predators out there. And if giants of that size exist, and evidence more and more suggesting they do, you know, there's not much that can stand up to a 175-foot long squid.
Absolutely. Well, like you were mentioning there as well, the Humboldts are ferocious, as well as I've seen a couple of documentaries about people going out there trying to look for. I remember one particular documentary a few years ago that I saw, which I think was on Nat Geo. And they were
Monster Quest.
Yes, it probably was that one where they were looking for these squids, because obviously people were saying how aggressive they were, and people were very interested what made these particular types of squid this aggressive. And I remember them catching one and bringing it up, and as they were bringing it up, another one came and started eating it. And I was like, good God.
Oh, they're definitely cannibalistic. If you're hurt. It doesn't matter if you're in the same pack or pod or school, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
You know, you're on the menu. But the Monster Quest episode, that show actually got its start because they came so close to proving a mega squid. They
yes.
actually attached a camera, an infrared camera, to a 6-foot umbel, and then they dropped them down with a cable attached to it, and she or it got attacked by a ginormous squid. You see, like, it coming at it, arms reaching, etc. They think it managed to dodge it because they got the camera back and all. But and they were trying to use focal length estimates, and they estimated that if it was built like another Humboldt, and Humboldts don't have the long feeding clubs shoot out like Architeuthis and some do. They rely more on just grabbing at like the clawed suckers and all that, instead of like lashing out, snagging and pulling you back toward it. But then they said that it was like 60 feet long.
Yeah.
And that's a big squid.
Yeah.
I mean, without the long, that's too big for a sperm whale to eat. That's as big as a bull sperm whale, a good sized bull sperm whale. At least nowadays they used to get bigger, but, so I mean, that's kind of evidence right there. There's actual footage of that. Then they did another episode. They wanted to get proof positive because, you know, there was always contention. Well, how big was this squid really? And so you could see, because it's in the background coming.
Yes.
So much bigger than the 6-footer that they were using as bait. Okay. But, you know, there was, you know, people, nobody wants to believe, obviously, until it grabs you and then you're like, oh, it's real. Ah. You know. So what they took. Imagine your last thought. Son of a.
That's right. Brings it.
Ah! They have all these memes about me out there because, you know, I've done some dumb, crazy stuff in my life.
Yeah.
And I think the alligator incident was one. When my wife was pregnant with our daughter, we took my dad to Florida. We were shore fishing and this big alligator tried to eat my father. And I had to fight the alligator to protect my dad. And I'm using a landing net, you know, fishing net, eat up the head, all this stuff and all this. So now there's like these, all these hold my beer memes out there about me. You know, like, I mean, like crazy stuff, you know, like God bless them. They come up with this stuff and all that. I am kind of stupid though. I mean, I've done the bungee jump, you know, which a lot of people do and all, but I mean, just, I remember just recently, like last summer, we were driving back from like the Poconos and this huge female black bear is walking across the street, the road, and all the cars are stopping for her. And she has like 3 cubs. One was a slowpoke. She had to go back and get him, whatever. So, and I'm like jumping out of the car with my phone. I'm like, hold on, I'm going to follow him into the woods and film them. But they were gone instantly. And I'm thinking, I'm going to come back all like shredded up and bleeding. And
if you look
at the last footage on there, is like these jaws coming out of the camera. It gets pretty dumb. You know, so maybe the whole my beer thing actually has some merit. No. Not the sharpest tool in the shed.
Yeah. I've always been interested as well, because especially in the modern era, Max, people tend to focus on stories of giant squids and things. But I'm very interested when people seem to dismiss the other giant that is often rumored to be lurking around. And for many, is probably a more intelligent and dangerous predator, which is the giant octopus.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, obviously, the best record that we've got of such a creature is that one that was washed up in Florida at the end of the 19th century. Now, that one, I mean, there are photos of it. There's even a bit, I mean, whether it's still preserved, I think in the Smithsonian, a piece of the body, a tiny piece, but it's been analysed and obviously proven to be of the octopi family. Would you suspect that if any predator was able, you know, if an octopus was able to grow to a gigantic size, that would be even a more fearsome creature because of their intelligence?
There is a section in Monsters or Mysteries about giant octopi. And first question, the question about intelligence, absolute. The octopus, when I wrote the Kraken series, like these octopus gigantists that I have in there are lethally smart as well as enormous and dangerous and deadly. Octopi have brains that are proportionally larger than that of many mammals, first off, which says something. And 2/3 of their additional neurons, besides that, they have brain neurons all through their arms.
Mm.
So if you total all that, they're to the point where they can actually assign some of their tentacles a task and then focus on something else to forget about it.
Yeah.
It's almost like as if it's like two entities there. Like, so if an octopus is trying to open a jar with a crab in it, it can assign 2-3 tentacles to do that. And then it can write a paper on clam bellies, watch the news. You know what I'm saying? They're highly intelligent. They're highly adaptive. They communicate with people. They are emotional creatures. We know they dream because it's been filmed. And
yeah,
as they're sleeping, you can actually see their colors and shift and change the patterns, which mimics what they're feeling and such. I would never eat an octopus. Mm. I mean, that would, like, that's like a sentient creature, highly intelligent animal.
Yeah.
And I, you know, but I had the pleasure of interviewing a gentleman named Demetrius, and him and two of his friends back in, I think it was 2013 or 2014. I don't have it in front of me, but they were down in Florida's Sanibel Island, and they had rented a fishing boat. They had a charter. They had on a 55 foot boat. And they were like, I think a mile and a half offshore or something. Or was it 3 miles? I don't remember. I apologize. But they were drift fishing and using some sort of nasty, you know, disgusting bait.
Yeah.
And all that. And it must have attracted something. So they were putting all this like blood and nasty gore and stuff into the water. And all of a sudden, they're all three of them are standing there, and 20 feet from where they are at the railing or the gunnels, whatever you want to call it, they see a 30-foot tentacle come to the surface. They see 30 feet of it.
Yes.
And it reaches right over to the boat, and they're just watching it. And it starts touching, feeling the side of the boat. And they think this is completely normal. When he reached out to me, he thought all octopuses get this big. And I'm like, no. I'm like, how thick was this tentacle? And he goes, I think at the thickest point, it was about 3 feet thick. And I'm like, whoa. And he described the color and the texture and all this stuff. And they said it wasn't aggressive. They thought it was curious. And then I asked him, like, did you see more? He goes, oh, yeah, there was a lot more other tentacles down there. We could see through the water. It was murky. And we saw the body, and they estimated the whole animal was 80 or 90 feet long.
What?
I mean, I have our messages saved and all that, because we're talking on a Facebook Messenger, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
And then after it was feeling the sides of the boat, okay.
Yeah.
Then it just pulled back, and it went back under, and then the creature floated away deep down, and it was gone. And I said, well, you're very lucky, I said, because it wasn't curious. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you see, octopi have chemoreceptors in their suckers, their taste buds.
Mm.
So he was tasting the boat to see if it was like a dead or sleeping whale.
Yeah.
Understand? I said, and if he had decided that maybe he got some of your bait on his suckers and stuff like that, and decided that it was edible, it's quite possible that this thing would have wrapped around the boat, God forbid. And, you know, maybe, God forbid, it touched a person. It was like, oh, well, this isn't edible, but here's an hors d'oeuvre at least. Decide.
Yeah.
This is not one of those hold my beer moments where, oh, I'm going to jump in the water and film this thing underwater. No. Okay. But so yeah, I mean, these three eyewitnesses. And then the weird part is that they get back to shore and they were like, man, that was crazy. Did you see that thing? And they go into a library, because these are old school guys, you know, like they're older, and they pull up books. And he even sent me like the book they pulled up to look at different types of tentacles. And they were positive it was an octopus. They showed cuttlefish, squid, and all this other stuff like that.
Yeah.
So then he said they reached out to, it was either the harbor master or the Coast Guard. I think it was the harbor master, and said, look, there's this ginormous octopus not far from shore. It's there. And the response was something like, yeah, yeah, we know. He's been here for like 3 days now. And, you know, like, hello, what? I mean, it's always struck me as odd because, I mean, they are carnivorous.
Mm.
And it dawned on me, or I figured that there was another incident that had happened around the same time, or like within a few weeks or months. It's called the Sanibel Sea Serpent, which is also in Monsters and Marine Mysteries. And this couple, they were close to shore, Sanibel, and they saw something 40 feet long swim under their boat. And then all of a sudden something shot out from it, wrapped around a manatee, pulled the manatee under, and they were terrified and they ran for their lives, or voted for their lives, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But, and so with all the manatees there, it occurred to me that is probably a popular feeding station for these enormous cephalopods. I mean, a manatee is like a giant cheeseburger.
Yeah.
You know, slow, fat, blubber rich, no defense means, more or less. You know, it's like 1,000 or 1,200, whatever pounds they weigh of instant food.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these creatures, you know, may be come there periodically looking for a meal.
Mm.
I wouldn't want to be in the water with one, though, when it happens, you know.
Obviously, when we're talking about creatures with such intelligence as well, Max, these are going to work out when the prime feeding times are. So they're probably going to be following these guys about. They might not be sort of eating them all the time, but they're going to position themselves in a way that they can take advantage of this delicious series of food that's easily available for them, because they are this clever. They can work things out like that. It's been proven that octopi are incredibly intelligent and can solve numerous puzzles.
Yeah, I think we should put a few of them in Congress here. I'm so not kidding. And they'd be less slimy. Okay. Mucus and everything. But anyway, historically, there are a lot of sightings from Hawaii that go back, I think they're in like the 60s and 70s or something.
Yeah.
I'd have to pull up the files, but where they had seen extremely large octopuses, and they seemed to show up at the time the green turtles are coming ashore to lay their eggs.
Mm.
And green turtles can weigh 600-700 pounds. Once again, you've got a slow moving, easily accessible source of meat.
Yeah.
See? So, I mean, one person saw an octopus that had a body the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. And it was on a reef and it was being attacked by sharks that it was fighting off. He said some of its suckers were the size of small truck tires. That's how big it was. So, it would seem to me like if they go there to eat the green turtles, the other ones would go to Florida to eat the manatees. That makes sense.
Yeah.
You go where the food is.
Yeah. Around the U.S. especially, and it going up the especially the Pacific coast seems to be more prevalent with some of these stories. Are there other sort of hot spots for other large behemoths of the deep? Because I know you've uncovered this remarkable story about these chaps that encountered a giant turtle, which is another of these sea creatures that occasionally we will hear stories of people encountering turtles that look essentially like cars at sea, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I personally it's got to be 20 something years ago. But I went out shark fishing out of New York, and we were about 20 miles offshore driving along, and we passed a dead loggerhead turtle, and it was upside down, belly up, dead. And at the time, I didn't realize how big it was. Like, I think the world record is at 1,200 pounds. This turtle was at least twice that.
Yeah.
In terms of weight. I mean, its shell was the length of, I would say its shell was probably maybe 6 feet long and close to a yard thick.
Wow.
It was a huge, beefy thing. You know, it must have weighed a ton, if not more, but it was upside down dead. We stopped, we were looking at it to see if sharks were nibbling on the carcass, in which case we would have set up shop right there to start fishing. But we didn't see any of that, and we just went on our way. So, I mean, right there, you know, I mean, I personally seen a loggerhead that's much, much bigger than the existing quote world record. But the Lamata sighting is the one you're talking about. That's out of Vancouver Island, British Columbia, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So that goes back to 1969. And there were actually two people involved in the sighting. That was Gary Lamata, who was best known for it. He passed away. But and his friend Earl Stoziger, who I actually reached out to, and great guy. Him and his wife are the sweetest people. I interviewed him extensively and discussed everything in detail because he was there that day and he saw the turtle also. And I wanted to get a firsthand accounting and a lot of updates in terms of what actually took place, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it was quite revealing. And Gary died literally 10 years ago, sadly. I also spoke to his widow. So, see, I'm thorough. I really, you know, get out there and stuff. But so originally, one of the misnomers for the incident is that the two men were on the same boat. Like, they say that Earl was Gary's crewmate, and that's not true. They were both fishermen. They had two separate boats. Both, Gary had a boat called the Anna L. which is 36 feet long, and Earl had a 30-foot boat called the Sea Pride, or Sea Pride 3, I think. Mm-hmm. So, but these were wooden fishing boats with wheelhouses up in the front, cabins below deck, that kind of stuff. And it's an interesting thing about the size of their boats. And the reason I mentioned it is because when you're a boater, a fisherman, you sail. So based on that and your experience, you could get a good idea of how big a boat is based on what you've known and seen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if you're on a boat and your boat is 30 feet long and you see another 30 foot boat, you're like, oh, that's a 30 footer. That's a 36 footer. That's a 40 footer. You know, you'll be pretty close. You'll be in the ballpark.
Yeah.
So this turtle turned out to be as big as the larger boat, 38 feet long. So they had something really good to compare it to. So what was happening is at the time, Gary was obsessed with his Super 8. He had the Super 8 like film camera. You know, it had actual footage or whatever, you know, like an old, really old school family movie camera you would use. Back then, it was the iPhone of the day from the late 60s.
Yeah.
And like boys with toys, he would go around filming everything and anything, et cetera. I mean, if his wife told me, his widow, that there are loads of boxes of old footage, et cetera, and stuff. I don't think there's any more of the giant turtle, but, you know, but the point is you know, and Earl said that too. He was always filming stuff. So he got out of, they both left out of Walters Cove, which is on the northwest side of Vancouver Island. And it's what they call a, mispronounced as Q-quad sound. I probably said that wrong. But anyway, and this is the crack of dawn. They go out there. They go to a popular fishing spot they like. Weather's good. Sea is flat, calm. So basically optimal conditions. And there was, a salmon run of some kind going on at the time, which probably explains why this thing was there.
Mm.
I think this, you know, this animal is, in my opinion, is a piscivore. It eats fish.
Yes.
So on their way to this spot that they're heading to fish, which they called Grassy, I'm not mistaken. There's a shallow point there where the fish would congregate, and that's where they were heading. The water in that area was about 180 feet deep, and the grassy part, it was like 70 or 80, something like that. More, you know, shallower. So that's where they're heading.
Yeah.
So the point is that Gary is about a quarter mile ahead of Earl. And, you know, they're not boating together. And they had portable radios. And then all of a sudden, Gary starts radioing Earl in a panic, saying, there's a sea monster out here. Get out of here, quick. Hurry up, stuff. And all. So he's filming this with his camera while he's waiting for Earl to get there. And so what happens is, by the time Earl gets there, the creature has submerged. Gary stops filming and he's pointing at a section of water between the two boats. Like Earl pulls up almost next to him. And then Earl looks down and underneath them is a rock pile, like the upcropping, I guess I'd call it, like a pinnacle from the ocean floor.
Hmm.
And the water depth there, like if most of the water there is like 60 or 70 feet, that water was only like 6 or 8 fathoms, he told me. So 36 to 48 feet, something like that. So let's say 40 feet.
Yeah.
And on top of this reef is this thing. And the water's clear. You could see it. Okay. And at first he thought it was a gigantic sea lion. It had sort of like a sea lion like bill. Pale gray to grayish white in color and all. And as literally as big as his boat. And they start realizing what they're looking at. And then the animal, Earl, starts circling. And then the thing just takes off quick and quiet and it's gone. When they developed the footage, you could see the thing's head had been like, before Earl got there, the animal had come up out of the water, like its head and neck had stuck out and it was turning and looking around and it was looking right at Gary. I mean, I took a couple of the stills from the footage and I enhanced them and you could see. I mean, people say, oh, I can't see that, stuff like that. That's baloney. I'm going to be polite here, okay? for the sensors and all that. That's baloney. All right. You look at this thing, you could see the eyes. You could see the, you know, bulbous eyes. You could see the thick ridge under the eyes. You could see the beak. You know, you could see the thick skin under the throat and all this stuff. And this thing was looking right at him. And he said just the head and neck was 8 feet long. And that's a big Adam.
Yeah.
But the fact that it was looking at him was a little disturbing also. I mean, God, well, he was curious. But I asked Earl, I said, were you like scared? He goes, oh, are you kidding? He goes, I was quite afraid. I was like, the thing was, it was as big as my boat. And I was afraid if he got mad at us, he was going to come up and he could like capsize us or who knows what, you know? But the interesting part was like that, the description they gave, and even though they said it was sort of like a shellless turtle, it wasn't as broad as a regular turtle. Like it didn't have a shell. So it was more like a leatherback, but a slimmer version.
Mm.
And yeah, it had like the large front flippers. It had the small hind flippers. It didn't have a shell, or it had like a leathery shell, but it was very fast. He said it was capable of tremendous speed when it moved there. And that makes sense because a leatherback has been clocked at 22 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And this thing would, if it was slimmer, bigger and more athletic, would be faster. So, and I think that's what it is. I think this is a, you know, he got footage. I mean, once you see the enhanced frames, let's put it that way, and then you look at the footage again and you know what you're looking at, it just jumps out at you. And you see this big head, neck bobbing up and down the water. You see its fins. There's some undulation to hold its position, and it's looking right there. It's right there. I mean, it's a grainy, worn copy, but he kind of, short of a body, got proof positive of this thing existing. And his wasn't the only sighting. There was in that area, there was another sighting. I don't know if it was that year or the next year, of something that sounds identical. Guy said he heard a sound. He turns around and this big 6 foot neck and head is sticking out of the water looking at him. Why are they looking at me? I don't know. You know? It's a little unnerving.
Just a little. Absolutely. I'm always very perplexed, Max, whenever we hear these stories, because often these are experienced seafaring people. These are people that work on the oceans, that it's their day-to-day job for, you know, often I think people forget about how tough and resilient you have to be if you are working at sea consistently, and either as a, you know, in any aspect of it, whether you're a fisherman or a trawler or you're oyster hunting or whatever. It's hard work. You get to know what's in your area, the flora and fauna that you come across. They know everything that they are expected to come across. So whenever somebody comes forward with an encounter with a larger than normal creature of a variety of descriptions, do you find it frustrating that people just dismiss these guys out of hand? Because there's always this old fashioned notion, Max, that tall tales of sailors, and I don't understand why we dismiss people who have far more experience of the sea and the creatures in it than the vast majority of people that are very quick to criticize and dismiss these claims.
I think that people are the old doubting Thomas thing by nature, like if I didn't see it, it doesn't exist, or you know, they don't. I mean, it's easy to dismiss somebody, but you know, what happens when you see yourself? I mean, I've encountered, you know, one or two things in my day that I'm afraid to tell people, like some of the stuff that I've come across, because you'll be mocked or whatever, but I know what I saw. I saw it up close and personal, and it was not my imagination or anything like that. You know, it's real and that's all there is to it. But, you know, I mean, there are tall tales out there. There are people that tell stories. I mean, for God's sake, the Loch Ness Monster hoaxes are an ongoing thing. Yeah. Like a tourist trade. You know, how are we going to hoax them this time? What's it going to be? You know, this type of stuff. But, I'm not a fan. But, you know, there are a lot of hoaxes. And I think that kind of makes people suspicious more. You know, I also think there are, I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist when I say this, which I take as a badge of honor, but whatever. But I think there are people in government positions, let's say, who deliberately promote or spread hoaxes, et cetera, which makes the real sightings, which they don't want people to know about, see, more easy to discredit or less likely to be taken seriously. Mm. You know, like when the super predator thing hit and everybody was talking about how a 9 or 10 foot great white shark got eaten by something, you know, and it was like this viral thing. Oh, we got to rush out some documentary. It seemed like that was sort of happening and put a silence all this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, but the truth is that something did happen to that shark. Something did eat it, apparently. What was it? Who knows, et cetera. But yes, I mean, you know, I don't, listen, if you don't believe, that's up to you. You know, there like was that Shakespeare line, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your limited philosophy, Horatio. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Horatios out there. Yeah. I'm going to start calling all the doubting Thomases. All right, Horatio, whatever you say.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me. You know, as I said at the beginning, Max, when we were talking about these strange things that are found in the sea, that we've got bodies of evidence of incredibly strange creatures being discovered, being washed ashore. As I said about the squid often being dismissed until, you know, the evidence essentially jumped up and punched marine biologists in the face and they couldn't ignore it anymore. And you have this with a variety of things. I'm perplexed when people, you know, one of the best examples is the megamouth shark, which was accidentally caught by a US marine trawler, I believe, that was looking for something else and accidentally caught one. And that weighed a ton. And you know, that was 1976. And yet we're still in a situation where people just completely dismiss some of these first-hand accounts as, oh, well, that can't be true. And you think, well, we only discovered the megamouth 45 years ago by accident. And there's been other creatures seen. I mean, there's the famous footage from Japan of that shark that they're just filming the seafloor and that shark just comes in and starts eating the camera. And they're like, what the hell is this that they'd never seen before? So for you, do you think what other sort of potential giants could be there? Or do you think there are plenty of marine species that we've yet to even encounter?
Unencountered new species or undocumented, however you want to call it, I mean, is a mathematical certainty. New species are discovered all the time. Larger ones, not as often, but I mean, they've got a new species at work recently.
Yep.
They've got several new beaked whales. These aren't small animals. So if people say, oh, well, you know, they look like another beaked whale, looks like another killer whale, this type of stuff. But you know what? There have been a lot of people that have claimed to see extant mosasaurs.
Yep.
Or something like that, some sort of swimming marine reptile. And I explored that also in there, including a study of a baby, like a calf orca that was bitten by something, which has bite marks that look suspiciously like a reptile's jaws. But anyway, if you're a mosasaur, let's say, you're adapted to marine life. So you're this large, smooth, dark colored thing that comes up for air every so often, et cetera. Well, reptiles don't respirate like mammals, like when they come to the surface, like a crocodile or a sea turtle. When they come up for air, they just like release bubbles, like lots of bubbles, and then they inhale and they're gone. There is no blow like a whale does. No,
yeah.
And this giant spout, okay, water vapor, which you could hear and see for, you know, hundreds of yards. There is none of that. So if you come up to the surface, if you're some large mosasaur like thing and all they break surface is your back, etc., you look like a whale.
Mm.
And that's all there is to it. So unless somebody jumps in with you and lands in front of you, which I wouldn't recommend, but whatever, then that's all that people are going to see. You know, there have been, I mean, many, many, many sightings, and I've historically dated them in interviews going back from, you know, 100 years to the present, and a lot of around New Zealand and places like that. But does that mean they're out there? I don't know. Is there some sort of marine crocodile with flippers instead of legs that still alive or has evolved? I mean, who knows what? But there does seem to be evidence leaning that way. The thing about reptiles like that, though, is like the squid, for example. Seeing a squid is very unlikely because most of the time, except at night, they're very, very deep down. And the larger animals, when it dies, they're not floating. They're going to sink right to the bottom and they're going to be scavenged and so forth and so on, eaten by other squid. A bulk of a giant squid's diet is smaller squid.
Mm.
So it's kind of like a self-supporting ecosystem or food web, whatever you want to call it, I guess. But so, you know, the evidence doesn't stick around, and they don't have skeletons, just a beak, and that doesn't last long and all that. But anyway, so, I mean, that's one thing. But I mean, like animals like crocodiles, plesiosaurs, et cetera, they all ingest gastroliths. These are stomach stones, and they use those for a combination of ballast and to help in digestion. I think it's more the ballast thing because their lungs are filled with air that would normally make it hard for them to sink. So they counter that by eating smooth stones, which they keep in their stomachs.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that when they die, and I've said this before in interviews, hunters in Africa, if they decide to shoot an Nile croc, they always try to shoot them when they're on the shore sunning themselves. Because if they shoot them in the water and they die, they sink.
Yeah.
And they don't get them. And you ain't going in there after it. Okay. If you understand, unless you know you want your wife to collect on your hefty insurance policy. So that reminds me, I have to pay my premium. But anyway, so my point is so a marine reptile that has a similar thing, like we know plesiosaurs have stomach stones. You know, when it dies, if it's still around, it's going to do the same thing. It's going to sink to the bottom and it's going to be scavenged and it's going to be gone. You know, that's just the way it goes. So, I mean, anything's possible. The ocean is a vast, vast world all onto its own. I mean, I'm betting dollars to donuts there are very, very large marine life forms down there that have yet to be encountered. Or maybe they have been. And like you said, like somebody didn't survive the experience, you know. I mean, I hate to say it, but a mosasaur with a 6 or 8 foot skull, a person is like the ideal meal size or something like that.
It is. And when you come across so many stories of people, even swimming in fairly well-known locations around the world that just vanish and people go, it's a riptide. And yet, when we talk about some of the creatures that we've mentioned today, especially when we're talking about sharks and octopus, the potential for a large, voracious predator to be lurking in the shadows, you know, especially if it's, say, an octopus, it's so clever just to, and so quick to be able to just snatch somebody and you're gone. That's it. Nobody will ever see you again. And it's the same kind of thing when you're talking about these giant reptiles as well, that they can just appear and disappear within seconds because of the size, the speed, and the ferociousness of them.
Oh, there was one of those New Zealand sightings. I don't have it in front of me where, like, these these teens were out on jet skis, and according to them, okay, this was only in the last like 10 or 15 years, I think, a huge creature breached like right next to their jet ski or behind, or I don't remember exactly the details, but it must have been aiming for one of the jet skis, and it came straight up and it crashed back down, and they described it as a gigantic mosasaur. So it seemed to be targeting the jet skis, if, you know, like it was a fishing lure or something like that, trying to nail it. But that's what seems to happen. I mean, I had in terms of the squid thing, and this is documented, there is one of the incidents was a guy doing one of the yacht races with a trimaran.
Yes.
And his boat was seized by a very big squid that came up and latched onto like the rudder and, you know, that stuff, and was stopping or the boat from moving or slowing it down considerably and trying to pull it under. And the squid, because it was a sailing vessel and the shapes of the hulls, I think it was like 100 feet long, something like that. I believe the squid thought that it was looking at a trio of blue whales or finbacks.
Yeah.
And it came up and it was trying to prey on a whale. And we know that they kill whales because there's a documented one that's in the book of a right whale, and a squid killed its calf, and the mother couldn't protect it and dragged it under it and ate it. But in this instance, they saw the squid's arms and all that, and the captain said that its arms were as thick as his leg. If you think about I have images in there of 25 foot squid, and its arms are only like 2 inches thick. They're nothing to look at. I mean, I'm guesstimating from the photo and stuff like that. But so if you scale up, you know, he said like the animal was like, and I'm assuming he was talking about just the body.
Yeah.
It was like 8 or 9 meters long. So if you add the arms to that, that's at least double that, if not more. So you're looking at a very large squid, and a squid that was ambitious enough to think it could kill a 100-foot whale. So, you know, they're out there.
Have you found that, obviously, since your novels have reached the levels of popularity, and obviously the book that you released, the Monsters and Marine Mysteries, Max, have you found that people are very open in coming forward to you because you're very open-minded? You're not. What I've always found about yourself when you're talking about these things, you don't sort of jump in with both feet, because often out there you can find, you know, according to some people, there are giant populations of megalodons swimming around the oceans. Whereas when I've heard you speak and seen some of the articles you've written and the discussions that you've been involved in, you are very balanced about this, because you do base your research and your thirst for a quest in regards to some of these creatures in a more measured way. Yeah, reserved, measured, whichever way you want to look at it, Max, that you kind of, you're open to the possibilities, but you're not sort of all in some of these far out and outlandish ideas that we have got remnant populations of dinosaurs and giant, you know, 90-foot sharks swimming around the world's oceans.
Well, I a lot of people have given me positive feedback for Monsters and Marine Mysteries, like in terms of the reviews. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a running theme from the feedback from the reviews that they've said things like, they really like the fact that, first off, I provide oodles of evidence, you know, that references all included, which is great with the Kindle version of Monsters and Mysteries, because all the links are there. You can click on a link and it takes you.
Yep.
The internet writes it. You know, you don't have to do any work. So it's pretty easy. But so I provide all the science, the estimates. I try to be as conservative as possible. When I was looking at like sharks and how big, we got some gigantic shark bites out there.
Yeah.
I mean, like that for the book. And I'm 100% convinced, based on like these two bites that we got on a whale carcass. They were both 27 inches wide. The larger, or the one with the higher deep, was 37 or 38 inches high. I mean, it's enormous. Much bigger than Bruce the shark from Jaws.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, so I had the crunch numbers as formulas, how big is the shark? And there were three available formulas from assorted elastomer branchologists out there. I crunched the numbers and two of them were giving me like big numbers, like 35 feet. So like, I'm like, that can't be right.
Yeah.
You know, that seems a little much. And I went with the most conservative one, which still indicated an animal at least 26 feet long.
Yeah.
And that seems realistic. If you picture a shark that has a jaw that opens at least 3 feet in height, that's a big shark.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so, but my point is that, so I try and do all this, and I try and give all the evidence in such a way, and I give my opinion. You know, I prepare it with, you know, you have to, you know, err on the side of caution, let's say. They also like the fact that I'm a little snarky and funny and obnoxious and telling the stories. I don't, yeah, you know, I don't like just spiel out like facts and figures, and people feel like they're in class and school and they're like, oh, I'm gonna die, you know, like that kind of thing. But like, for example, here, there's can I read just a random section?
Of course you can. Fire away. I'd be delighted to.
This was a discussion of like the turtle. Okay, so it says, last but not least, there is one matter I haven't touched on, one that several readers have brought to my attention. That is a matter of reproduction. If what Gary saw was an overgrown turtle, why aren't we seeing them lumbering ashore to lay their eggs? A fair question. True, the prehistoric sea turtle Archelon most likely laid its eggs on shore, like extant sea turtles. But there's a big difference between a 3 to 4 ton Archelon dragging itself up onto the beach and a near 30 ton monster doing so. Besides the physical constraints of not having seawater to support its tremendous bulk, one would think that such a sight would certainly be noticed by people. But as the famous quote goes, nature finds a way. And that way takes the form of a different means of giving birth. It has long been accepted that plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs gave birth SE to live young, and most sources are believed to have done so as well. But in June of 2020, a paper titled "A Giant Soft-Shelled Egg from the Cretaceous of Antarctica" gave evidence that a large creature, possibly a mosasaur, but this was not confirmed, had laid the egg. An egg that was thin-shelled and designed to hatch immediately upon being expelled into the water. This may have applied to mosasaurs, and or it may have also applied to a form of sea turtle, one that broke through the evolutionary and anatomical barriers that keep turtles oviparous, parentheses, egg-laying. Viviparous animals give birth to live young, and ovoviparous animals lay eggs that hatch inside the mother's body and are born alive. It is possible this huge turtle does the next best thing, laying eggs, but eggs designed to be torn open by the hatchlings at the moment of their birth. The fossilized egg would have obviously been stillborn, i.e. a dud. And then, of course, the link is attached there. So, you know, and it goes on. Is there anything in the fossil record and all this other stuff? So I try and present everything to people in such a way that it's not boring. You know, there I didn't find any snarky comments in there or anything like that, you know. But the point is you give them the evidence and you take a Solomon-like, I guess, stance on things and let people draw their own conclusions.
I think that's always the best way to be.
Yeah, you don't want to beat people over the head and say, oh, there's, like you said, a sea full of 90-foot megalodons out there, and they're going to get us and all this stuff. No, there aren't. Is there evidence of some mega sharks out there? Yes, I have collected it. Okay. Are they 90 feet long? No. Possibly maxing out in the high 30s or 40 feet. You know, are they a megalodon? Probably not. Most likely what some marine biologists have already stated, and I'm aligning with them, that it's most likely an occasional great white that experiences what's called gigantism and doesn't stop growing.
Yeah.
You know? And that makes sense because the tooth marks, in Monsters Marine Mysteries, a great marine biologist named Simon Pierce, who, you know, gave me the images of this whale shark he filmed and all that. He took photos of a 40-foot female whale shark off the Galapagos Islands. I call the shark that attacked at the Galapagos giant. And there's a bite mark on this bust-sized whale shark's flank, left rear flank, that's 4 feet across. Now it's healed, but you can see individual tooth grooves from the bite. It's not an old bite. It hasn't completely filled in, meaning like when whale sharks have wounds, they fill in the tissue and everything. Eventually, it almost disappears.
Yeah.
So I don't think this bite is more than a year or two old, which means that there may be a shark out there with jaws pushing 4 feet wide.
Mm.
That's insanely huge. But the really pointy grooves seem to suggest a white. Yeah. Or unless Otodus chubbutensis is still around, the extinct ancestor of Megalodon, which I think is more unlikely. But, you know, who knows? Maybe I fish and I catch one, you know? Can you imagine? Oh. He's taking the head of a man dying.
Yeah.
So, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I used to quote the first time I went shark fishing and I was fighting this world record blue shark. No joke. I released the world record. It would still be the world record today, but I wouldn't kill the fish.
Yeah.
And this thing was like 700 something pounds. And it was an hour long slugfest. And I'm doing stand up tackle with this giant shark. And I was quoting lines from Jaws to be funny the whole time in front of my friends.
Sure.
Well, after about 20 minutes, the combination of trying to breathe and stay alive, and that was not working. And I decided, let me just shut up.
Yeah.
Uber and Quint can take a back seat and focus on trying not to get pulled over the side by this fish. You know, so you learn these things. It's one of those hold my beer moments.
Very true. I think as well, when we look at it though, Max, we're only really aware of the potential size of great whites anyway, because of, I mean, how long is it since they discovered Deep Blue? The biggest one we've got on record so far? She's what, 25 feet, 26 feet?
They say 20 feet, actually. And I look and I'm not sure, because in some pictures she looks 20 feet or more. And in some pictures she does not. She looks like 18 feet, maybe. You know, sometimes these things say estimated 20 feet, around 20 feet, et cetera. You know, but I mean, there are larger ones out there. There's an 18 footer named Matilda that was photographed by Rodney Fox's son, Andrew Fox. And it has a huge bite mark on its face, like on the left side of its face, where a much bigger great white came up and really smashed on it. And I estimate that shark to be about the size of the one that we measure the bites on the dead humpback whale.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's more and more evidence out there. I'm quite confident that white sharks, not often, but rarely, whatever you want to call it, you know, top 8 meters, 25 feet.
Yeah.
But I just think, well, every once in a while, we probably get some mutant that just doesn't stop growing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's going to have a hard time because it's going to be so slow at that size.
Yeah.
You know, catching food is going to be a problem. I mean, that whale shark swim at like 5 miles an hour.
Yeah.
A shark that attacked it, you know, put the bite on it and couldn't finish the job.
Mm.
So the whale shark either bashed it in the head with its coat open with its tail, stunned it and kept going, or it just broke off and then swam away and the shark couldn't catch it. I mean, that doesn't make sense. It must be, how can you be that slow as a predator? You know, I don't know.
Yeah. We see all types of animals, both on land and in the sea, that occasionally there will be freaks of nature that are larger than everything else around them. So, once again, the possibility is there. We have the historical comparisons across all kinds of species, Max. So why not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mentioned this in Monsters and Marine Mysteries. I personally found there was a species of beetle, like this carnivorous beetle that I used to catch when I was a kid. And I used to keep them in like jars and stuff, you know, boys. And one time, you know, yeah, these beetles were never more than an inch long. They were small. And one time I caught one that was 2.5 times that size. It was insanely big. I mean, like a true mutant. an example of gigantism. And I researched it when I was looking at the book, and they don't get that big. So that it happens. The American American toads that normally max out around 4 inches or 100 millimeters, metrically speaking, sometimes get double that size, like 8 inches in body length, which would mean double that, be eight times the mass.
Yep.
So when you think about it, if you had a 20-foot shark that weighed 5,000 pounds, if it had gigantism, you could hit 40 feet, it would then weigh 40,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Or 20 tons. See? So, I mean, it's not outside the realm of reason. And something like that would be something to see. Not something you want to swim with, though.
Well, I'm going to say, be careful what you wish for, I think.
Need a serious fishing rod and reel for that thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cables, I think, more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than reel there.
And a winch.
Well, Max, what's next for you then, my friend? I know you've got the latest installment of the Cronus Rising has recently hit the shelf. So what else is on your agenda, and what else have you got planned coming up, my friend?
Well, I'm very excited because I hadn't done a Cronus Rising book in almost 2 years, because, you know, Monsters and Marine Mysteries was one book. I also wrote this great horror thriller, which is under wraps right now as well during that time period. But I also banged out a novella called Cronus Rising Purgatory, which picks up where the last Cronus Rising book, Cronus Rising Kraken Volume 3, ended. It's going to be a little bit of a spoiler, but I'm going to try and like do it in such a way that it's not, so bad. So in the series, there is a principal character whose name we shall not mention, okay, who was imprisoned in this research facility called Tartarus, and experiments were being performed there. And these pliosaurs, these giant prehistoric marine reptiles, these apex predators, were being, which are all over the place, and by the time the Kraken is around, were being experimented on as bioweapons. And the Blofeld type character running the facility, okay, using a James Bond term, was also experimenting on using them, like their bacteria, which they call Cretaceous cancer, and weaponizing it as well, and trying to make super soldiers and all this other stuff. So this one principal character had been experimented on the point that he turned into this 7-foot half man, half reptile thing. Sort of like the creature from the Black Lagoon, but much scarier and much, much more dangerous, and able to function on land quite well. So at the end of the Kraken book, the villain, this Grayson is his name, ends up on this mini sub, and the submarine has a built-in, what would you call it? I forget what the name was, an auto-driving system that brings it back to its last destination, which was this island where these pliosaurs came from, that caldera I told you about.
Yeah.
And inside that caldera, there is a rainforest that has prehistoric life in it, including these raptors, you know, like the velociraptors from Jurassic Park.
Yep.
Except that in my world, they've evolved to run on the surface of water, which is crazy. Yes. Because, you know, they have small rainforest areas, but they have this 8-foot saltwater lake. So they evolved these specialized feet with these scales that slide down, they give them like snowshoes to increase their, you know, how big their feet look. And they're able to, by speed, run across the surface of the water, catching fish, et cetera. So you've got these water running raptors in there and other stuff, et cetera. So this guy, this Grayson, the villain, ends up in Diablo Caldera Beach. He's getting out. He realizes where he is. And then all of a sudden he finds out that the person that he experimented on and turned into this monster had been stowed away on the sub and comes out and is coming after him. So then he's being pursued into the jungle, and the hero, the man reptile will call him, I don't want to say any names, realizes there's a bigger problem on his hands than him enjoying killing, getting revenge on the person who did this to him, imprisoned him for a decade in a dungeon, murdered his wife, etc. It turns out that all the time that these guys were researching on people and trying to turn them into super soldiers with this reptilian DNA from these prehistoric animals, they had been dumping the rejects of their experiments in this island, parachuting them in. So there are hundreds of these man-eating, man-like reptilian creatures, these troglodytes, that come at you in a slavering horde, like a wolf pack or hyenas, and drag you down and rip your guts open and start eating your intestines while you're still alive. And they're everywhere. Okay. So the hero now has to decide how he's going to fight his way through this, et cetera. The whole book, this is why it's called Purgatory, because he's like in hell.
Yes.
And so he's got this whole book is like this running fight to stay alive against these things. So if you like action and suspense and biting your nails while you're reading, the whole thing, 130 pages long, on and off, you're constantly doing this. It's a little exhausting, but the character arc, et cetera, all works out nicely. And people are really eating it up, pun intended.
Fantastic. Well, it's been a real pleasure to finally get a chance to speak with you and pick your brains over a variety of marine-based topics. Where can everybody follow your work, get your books, and keep up to date with everything else you're up to, Max?
Well, let's see. If they want to follow me personally, their best bet is to find me on Facebook, which is looking up under Max Hawthorne Author. There's a lot of people pretending to be Max Hawthorne for some reason. I don't know why. So just put the author on the end, you'll find me. But I post a lot of great stuff on there. My website is cronusrising.com, Cronus with a K, or maxhawthorne.com. I'm on Twitter and Instagram too, same thing, Max Hawthorne Author and stuff. But there's a newsletter from the website if people want. There's free book downloads on the website as well. All sorts of stuff. We do regular prize giveaways, raffles through the Facebook groups. On there, like I think right now we're raffling off a Mosasaur tooth fossilized and stuff. So yeah, people are welcome. I always enjoy talking to new people. I try and be very gregarious. I'm not like a, you know, obviously I'm not some introverted hiding under a rock type person or something like that, you know. At this point, what I write about creatures that hide under rocks, but I don't.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes as always. And once again, Max, it's been an absolute pleasure to finally speak with you. And hopefully, I will speak to you again in the future. You take care.
Thank you, Paul.